You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast entitled, How Do You Optimally Select Frontline Maintenance Therapy for Advanced Ovarian Cancer? We know about 85% of patients with advanced ovarian cancer will experience recurrence, and first-line therapy is often followed by maintenance therapy. As it is longer-term therapy, the choice of therapy is often guided by molecular status and the initial first-line treatment setting. However, disparities and inequities in ovarian cancer plague outcomes. And we're going to discuss this. I'm Ruthu Solani from University of California in Los Angeles, and I'm pleased to be joined by my partner and colleague, Dr. Dana Chase, who's also from the University of California in Los Angeles, to discuss best practices for selecting optimal frontline maintenance therapy in patients with advanced ovarian cancer. We'll also review strategies for mitigating inequities in ovarian cancer care in our communities. Welcome, Dr. Chase.
Thanks, Dr. Solani. Excited to be here and to talk with you about frontline treatment of ovarian cancer.
So, Dr. Chase, let's start by just discussing frontline maintenance therapy options. And I'm curious, you know, the landscape is constantly shifting, but I'm curious just when we start, what molecular testing do you first order when a patient's diagnosed with ovarian cancer?
Yeah, so what molecular testing do I order when a patient is first diagnosed with ovarian cancer? Thankfully, we now have what we call biomarker-directed therapy in the first line for ovarian cancer patients. So getting biomarker testing up front has become really important. And first of all, I'm going to mention BRCA, or otherwise known as BRCA mutation status. So definitely I order BRCA mutation status on the patient. These days, we order BRCA mutation status on the patient. And if the patient does not have a hereditary BRCA mutation, then we order it in the tumor. And that's called somatic testing or tumor testing for BRCA mutation. And then I also order one other tumor test, which is a test for homologous recombination deficiency. And homologous recombination deficiency is otherwise known as HRD. And some testing refers to this as LOH, or loss of heterozygosity, abbreviated as LOH. So I also order an HRD test, which also can help guide testing. If a patient, depending on their tumor type or depending on their family history, for example, I might order some additional tumor testing, such as MMR or mismatch repair status, or potentially MSI, which is microsatellite instability. That I kind of pick and choose a little bit in terms of when I order it, but sometimes I will also order those molecular tests.
Yeah, and I think we have similar practices. You know, getting NGS or next-gen sequencing testing is pretty standard, along with the germline testing that you mentioned. I think nowadays we actually have the ability to get the NGS testing up front, which gives us a lot more information than solely the HRD and BRCA status. And so we may see other HRR genes, if you will, as well as some of the other findings that you mentioned, including mismatch repair deficiency and some other immunohistochemistry testing that you can add that may influence future directions. But let's start with frontline maintenance therapy, since that's really what you kind of highlighted. And I'd love to just start by talking about some of the clinical trials that have really kind of established PARP inhibitors as part of the care in the treatment for patients with the BRCA HRD mutations, and maybe even have HRD positivity, and maybe even have a role in patients who are HRD test negative. So can I ask you to just start with some of the treatments that have looked at maintenance strategies in this population?
So what are some of the treatments and trials that have looked at frontline strategies for patients with ovarian cancer? There are some key trials that have completed and have been published over the last 10 to 20 years now at this point that have directed the therapies that we can use in maintenance. So when we talk about maintenance therapy, we're talking about what do we do after patients are on carboplatin paclitaxel. So they've finished or they've started their carboplatin paclitaxel. What can we add to that regimen either with chemotherapy and then in maintenance or in maintenance alone. And one of the first trials to look at this was GOG-218, or in Europe, it was called ICON-7. And those trials helped to establish the role of bevacizumab with carboplatin paclitaxel and then in maintenance for just all comers with ovarian cancer. Those trials did not include a biomarker. So at that point, we were just having to decide if we wanted to give bevacizumab with chemo and then in maintenance in all comers. After those trials, we saw SOLO-1, which was really this kind of groundbreaking trial in BRCA mutated patients, patients that either had a germline BRCA mutation and or a somatic or just a tumor BRCA mutation. And that led to the use of PARP inhibitors, specifically olaparib, in patients that are BRCA mutated. And of course, that showed really impressive kind of groundbreaking outcome data in these patients. And then after the SOLO-1 trial, we started to see other trials using PARP inhibitors, other PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer maintenance situation. And that was, those trials include the PRIMA trial, the ATHENA trial, and the PAOLA-1 trial. And those trials incorporated now either niraparib alone or olaparib with bevacizumab or rucaparib. And the interesting thing about those three trials is those three trials now not only included the BRCA mutated patients, but included patients that we now call HRD or homologous recombination deficient, and then also included patients that are HRP or homologous recombination proficient. So with those three trials, now we kind of also saw what it would look like to use PARP inhibitors in kind of the all-comer situation.
And I think it's really important to distinguish that we have bevacizumab maintenance that was done with the chemotherapy, PARP maintenance after chemotherapy, and then even the incorporation of bevacizumab followed by bevacizumab and PARP maintenance. So we have kind of different strategies. And I'm curious, like, how you decide which patient should go on which strategy. And, you know, you can just say PARP inhibitor, PARP bev, or bev alone.
Yeah, so how do I decide who's going to get a PARP inhibitor, PARP with bev, or bev alone, or potentially not get anything? And it can be a complicated decision, but definitely if a patient's BRCA mutated and she has not gotten bevacizumab with her carboplatin paclitaxel, that patient for sure in my practice goes on PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy. Usually it's recommended to start that within 3 months of completing carboplatin paclitaxel. But in my patient population that started bevacizumab with their chemotherapy, which I tend to reserve for stage 4 patients, incompletely or suboptimally debulked stage 3 patients, or patients that have kind of the neoadjuvant chemotherapy approach, those patients in my practice get bevacizumab with chemotherapy with their carboplatin paclitaxel. And then if they're BRCA mutated or if they're homologous recombination deficient or LOH, for example, I would add the PARP inhibitor with bevacizumab in maintenance, again, within 3 months of them completing their last cycle of carboplatin paclitaxel and bevacizumab. And then in the patient that is HRP, meaning they don't have a BRCA mutation and they're not homologous recombination deficient or HRD, that patient, if they've started bevacizumab with chemotherapy, I will continue them in bevacizumab with bevacizumab in maintenance. So usually, as long as they're a candidate and don't have any reason not to be on bevacizumab, I would put them on bevacizumab with chemotherapy and then continue bevacizumab in maintenance. Now, there's an occasional patient that has not started bevacizumab with chemotherapy. Perhaps that patient is a stage 3, completely, optimally debulked patient who I consider not as high risk. That patient, I might consider not adding any maintenance therapy to that patient, but it's going to be kind of a conversation with that patient as to whether or not, if she's homologous recombination proficient, she wants to or is okay with not being on any kind of maintenance therapy.
And it's important to remember that for those patients who are HRD test negative, that PARP inhibitor alone with niraparib is FDA approved, and that can be a discussion as well. So you have surveillance alone, bevacizumab, or a PARP inhibitor with niraparib in the HRD test negative patients. But I think the one thing you really highlight that I want to kind of reemphasize is the high risk of recurrence and really being thoughtful about strategies. One thing that also can happen is comorbidities or adverse events that patients may experience during frontline therapy that influence your ability to, you know, select the best maintenance therapy. What are some common adverse events that patients experience that might impact the decision?
What kind of side effects that the patient experienced during chemotherapy can kind of influence the choice for maintenance therapy? Well, one thing, first of all, is the patient has to understand that the PARP inhibitor is essentially like low-dose chemotherapy in a pill. So it's not like taking baby aspirin or a hypertension medicine, for example. So we do really have to be careful about nausea. We have to be careful about hematologic changes that we potentially saw during chemotherapy, like anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia. And then also have to be careful with patients that experienced a lot of fatigue during chemotherapy. So PARP inhibitors in general, that class of medication can cause fatigue, gastrointestinal side effects like nausea, vomiting, even constipation or diarrhea, and then also hematologic changes like anemia, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia. So if we're not careful, if that patient has not recovered from those side effects before starting the PARP inhibitor, you could potentially run into a lot of issues with side effects and complications putting that patient on a PARP inhibitor right away. So I think, you know, it's not like the patient is forbidden or is totally excluded from PARP inhibitor therapy if that patient experienced those toxicities during chemotherapy, but you really want to wait for those toxicities to get to a grade one or just totally go away before you start the PARP inhibitor. I think that's really important to remember and to think about.
And you mentioned that, you know, the studies actually allowed for 12 weeks between end of chemotherapy and starting the PARP inhibitor therapy. And that does allow that patient to have a little recovery time. So, you know, oftentimes I'll start kind of between that 6 and 8 week time frame when patients have recovered, but delay it for patients who may not have fully recovered. It also gives a patient a little break from treatment. So I think it's a little bit of sense of relief for patients before starting on this next phase of their treatment. So I think that's a really key point. And I love that you highlighted, you know, fatigue, hematologic, and GI effects, which, you know, patients can experience both from cancer and from treatment side effects. So the last thing I just want to highlight is that we do have some lab monitoring guidelines that are really important to make sure that those hematologic parameters really do, you know, stay within a safe zone, and remind patients that they often feel better with time, that their symptoms actually, their side effects actually resolve with time or improve. The last thing I want to just talk to you about is something that I think is really, really important. And this is that we are seeing some disparities in kind of all aspects of cancer care. This can translate to different survival outcomes based on race or ethnicity. And I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on how can we improve disparities in kind of multiple facets of ovarian cancer care. And I want to really start with genetic testing and enrollment on clinical trials.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, disparities exist in the ovarian cancer world in general. Unfortunately, for example, Black women, despite less commonly being affected by ovarian cancer, have a higher chance of being diagnosed at an advanced stage and also having worse 5-year survival rates. So definitely some work needs to be done in terms of educating certain populations of women, spending extra time educating certain populations of women about ovarian cancer, the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer, and helping patients to understand how to access care once they have these symptoms and sort of how to advocate for themselves when they're having these symptoms. A lot of women, before they're diagnosed with ovarian cancer, wind up in their primary care offices or in their family practice offices or seeing a gastrointestinal doctor for these side effects that are or symptoms that they have related to ovarian cancer. So educating patients about these symptoms and how to access care quickly when they have them. Unfortunately, also Black women and Latino or Hispanic women also are less likely to get genetic testing. So as I mentioned earlier, all women with ovarian cancer, fallopian tube, or primary peritoneal cancer should get a hereditary cancer test or a test for a BRCA mutation and some of the other homologous recombination repair genes as well. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that Black or Hispanic or Latina women are getting genetic testing like white women. So really important to also educate and spread the word, not just to patients, but also to providers, to family practice doctors, internal medicine doctors, OBGYNs, gynecologic cancer doctors, medical oncologists, that all women, regardless of age, regardless of race, regardless of family history, should get genetic testing if they have the diagnosis of an epithelial, ovarian, primary peritoneal, or fallopian tube cancer. And you know, some ways to do that potentially are to do, for example, implicit bias training for physicians and PAs or nurse practitioners, even nurses or genetic counselors. We need to improve patient navigation services, like helping patients in our medical systems kind of get access to this care. Potentially, we can offer video or phone genetic counseling to help patients that maybe live in more rural areas or areas that are far from medical systems. And then potentially do interventions in terms of insurance barriers. You know, some insurance companies, unfortunately, just make it harder to access genetic testing. So that we could probably work on that as well.
Yeah, that is very insightful. And I think it, you know, you mentioned genetic testing as a focus, but we are seeing disparities in access or offerings of clinical trials. And I think some of the measures you mentioned can also be used for that. And then lastly, I think adhering to guideline concordant care. So whichever guidelines you use, whether it's NCCN or other guidelines, and ensuring that all patients are staying on guideline concordant care, which is typically associated with better outcomes. And if there is a deviation, being very transparent about why that deviation is occurring. I think we have a lot of work to do, though. And I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, even though we don't think we're doing this in our own practice, it's happening. And so we need to be very mindful of it. I just personally want to thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. And I want to thank Dr. Chase for sharing her insights and experience with us on how to choose frontline therapy management options for patients with advanced ovarian cancer. And I'd like to thank you for joining us. We hope you'll listen to the second episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. A special thanks to our supporters, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck & Company Incorporated, who provided educational grants for this activity.